Good morning. I do believe that this year I've been assigned the hardest thing again. The hardest thing is not necessarily the material. The hardest thing is actually trying to get this many of you guys and myself awake this early in the morning on a Saturday morning. How many people, if given to your own devices, would still be in bed at 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning? Okay, see, my hand's up too. Okay. Yeah, his hand's up real high in the back there. So if there's no audio, we know why. He's asleep back there. Okay. So, when we start talking about deviations from the work, we talked last time about what the work is, right? And today we're going to start talking about deviations from it. One of the first things I wanted to point out is, error doesn't just happen. Nobody walks in and says, hey, I want to see if I can get 100 people to follow me into doing this. It never happens that way. Something small happens, and then it goes a little bit further, and it goes a little bit further, and it goes a little bit further, until now we're completely off the road. We're off the track, and we're off the leaves. It's always happened that way, and probably always will. Several of you said yesterday, I saw a number of hands go up when it said, do you have jobs? Raise your hands again if you have a job. Do you know the company you work for has a mission statement? How many of you know what that might be? I mean, you know what a mission statement is? It is the one thing that drives that company. That company says, this is what we do. This is what we're about. This is how we're going to serve our customers. This is how we're going to go about doing our job and our business and our day-to-day work. I was listening to a speaker not too long ago, and it's where I want everybody to get out. Either on the cover sheet of my session, on the front of your notebook, I don't care where you write this, I want you to write down three questions. Every organization, God's family, God's church is an organization. Every organization should know three things. What are we doing? Why are we doing it? Where do I fit in? What are we doing? Why are we doing it? And where do I fit in? You did not know I was going to start the morning with a quiz about last night, did you? What are we doing? We talked about this last night. The church. What is the church about doing? What are the things the church does? I'm comfortable with silence, so y'all going to have to break it. What does the church do? Somebody help me out. Worships. What else does the church involved in? Teaching the lost. Evangelism. Okay, I'll shorten it into one word. Worshiping. Evangelizing. What's the last one? Okay, edification, the building up. Give me one more. Benevolent. There you go. I saw you struggling. I know it's early, so I'll go ahead and put it up there. What is somebody give me a one-sentence definition of what is benevolence? What are we doing when we're talking about benevolence? I'm comfortable with silence. Caleb, you know the word? Helping what? Helping those needy saints. Yeah, I see people mouthing it. They just won't say it to me. Okay, we'll overcome that by the end of this session. If not, hopefully by the end of the day. So these is, if somebody was to ask as a part of the church, whether you're a part of the church here, or you're a part of the church at Pepper Road, or somewhere else, what are you doing? Well, we're worshiping, we're evangelizing, and we're helping. We're loving our brothers, we're helping. Why are you doing it? Well, John chapter 3, verse 16, the one we all know, for God so loved. He loved us first, right? We do this. We worship Him. We serve Him because He first loved us. There are more motivations than I have listed on the board. Not an all-inclusive list. But why do we teach? Well, the great, He said so. He said so. Go out and teach the gospel. Teach it to every nation and every person. And again, in 1 John chapter 3 and verse 17, if I have goods, if I have things, and I see my brother in need, and I don't help him, I'm missing something. I'm missing the love of God. Right? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your life. And the second commandment is likened to it. Love your neighbor as yourself. These are the concepts. These are the motivations that we see. And the last thing I want us to look at here is, where do I fit in? How many of you are either already been away or going away this year to live away from home, away from parents in college? Or you're already in the workforce and you're away from home. Okay, where do I fit in? This isn't about, what does my mom and dad do in the church? This isn't about what does my older brother or my sibling or someone else do. Where do I fit into the work? Where do I fit into this? And I think if you look at these three things, the simplicity that God has put His plan before us, the wonderful mystery that Oscar talked about last night that's been unfolded before us, there's not a person in this room that can't worship. Not a person in this room that can't evangelize. You can tell your friends. You can take that gospel message. God sent Him. They killed Him. God raised Him. We're witnesses. You can take that to your friends and your neighbors. You can be excited about it. And you can evangelize. And you can help each other out. You can help them be the same. The work of the church, there's nothing there that you can't do at the age you are today. Now, we talked about mission statements. When my boss hired me and I walked in on my first day of work, you know what he didn't do? He didn't walk into my office and ask me, "Hey, Tracy, what's your thought on my mission statement? Should we change what our company is about?" Did my boss ask me that? No. Who gets to define the mission statement? Who gets to define this is what the organization is about? The boss, the owner, right? They started the company. They decide, they define what the mission is. This is the church that Christ is the head, right? He defines what we're about to do. We talked about it last night. We're about to worship. We're about to evangelize. And we're to be helping each other. So we don't get to set that mission to Satan. That leads us into our thoughts for today. My first question for you is, are you willing to wait on the Lord? Are you willing to wait on the Lord? Now, we're looking at some things to where, especially in the book of Psalms, I'm in this horrible situation and I'm going to wait and see what God does about this. This is a different kind of waiting on the Lord. Are you willing to let God answer the question? Are you ready to let Him be the owner of the company and define that mission statement? Or am I going to try to get ahead of Him? In Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 1, walk prudently when you go into the house of the Lord. Draw near to hear rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools. When I go into the house of the Lord, the first thing I need to do is I'm drawing near to hear. When I go before God, I'm drawing near to hear. I could look at Psalms 130 and verse 5. I will wait on the Lord and I will hope in His Word. That's the kind of waiting we're talking about. I can't think of a better example of this than David in the Old Testament. I'm sure many of you know this story. David that's going to bring the Ark of the Covenant back into the city. And they come up with this great idea. We're going to put it on this what? We're going to put it on a cart. Thank you. And we're going to pull it back into the city. And as they're going, the cart stumbles. And who reaches out their hand? Uzzah. What happens? God strikes him dead. David's distraught. The people are distraught. It turns into the house of Obed-Edom. At a later time, David, in 1 Chronicles chapter 15 and verse 13, comes back and why had this happened? He made it clear. We did not do what? We didn't consult the Lord for His pattern. We did not consult the Lord for the order in which we should do these things. David, time and time again, when I think David, especially in his younger life, I think he inquired of the Lord. Every time David had a decision to make, every time something happened, David is on the battlefield. Should I go up and attack or not? Well, what did he do? He sent the priest. You go and you inquire of the Lord and come back and tell us what we should do. Are we going to have that kind of concept? Are we going to have that attitude in a world and in a time where people tell us, "Oh, you're making a mountain out of molehills. God really doesn't care about, you're just being a legalist. God really doesn't care about all this stuff." Well, if He cared enough to write it, then He does care about it. And are we willing to wait on what He has to say instead of developing our own? The apostles. Just another quick example of this. Apostles in chapter 4, they'd already been given the Great Commission. Christ is being raised. Christ is going back into heaven, and they're given the command, go and wait in the city. And the Helper, which I promise you, will come. They didn't rush out and go into the world and start preaching and teaching. They obeyed the command. They went. They were patient. They waited on the Lord, and with that, they received the gift of the Holy Spirit as time went along. And then Paul, during his conversion, Paul was blinded. And what was he told? You go back into the city and you wait. There it'll be told to you what you must do. Do we have that attitude? Do we have that mindset? Are you willing to wait on the Lord? Colossians chapter 3 and verse 17. Whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord, giving thanks to God the Father through Him. What does that term normally in the name of the Lord mean? If I was to say stop in the name of the law, it's the law that has the authority. I use this example a lot. If I was to run up behind Brian and say stop in the name of Tracy, Brian may stop as he falls over laughing into the floor, but that carries no weight with it. Stop in the name of the law, that carries weight with it. What we do, we should be able to do in the name of the Lord. Now, I have a question. If we can't find where the Lord says it, can we do it in His name? That's what waiting, that's the crux of what waiting on the Lord is about. If we can't find where the Lord says it, we can't do it in His name. So first, are we willing to wait on Him to give us the command? Second question, are we ready to rely on whatever He gives us is enough? Right? Whatever He says is enough. Are you willing to rely on what He says? In Romans chapter 1 and verse 16, Paul says, "For I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is power of God unto salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first and also the Greek." Paul says, "I'm not ashamed of the gospel." I believe this is key to the social gospel that's going out today. So many things are done to try to draw people in to hear. If we can do this, we can get people in the door just to listen. But with everything that we do like that, I think it's saying we are ashamed of the gospel. The gospel alone don't have the power to get people in the doors anymore, right? That's what we're being told. The gospel alone doesn't have the power to get people off the street to come in and listen. The apostles, Paul, "For I am ashamed, I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God and salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first and also the Greek." In Acts chapter 2 and verse 22, what does Peter say as he goes and he addresses the people in the first gospel sermon? It isn't, "Look at all these wonderful miracles I just did." "Men of Israel, hear these words." If you go and you look at the gospel, as the gospel goes out, you look at missionary journeys, you will see they go into a city, they find a synagogue, they find where God's people are meeting and talking and worshiping, and they do what? They preach. They preach. They take this gospel message that's here in the book of Acts. God sent him, you killed him, God raised him, we're witnesses. They take that everywhere they go. That's the power that they use to lead people to Christ. And if we employ anything else other than the gospel when we're going out and trying to draw people in, okay, the gospel has got to be what we take forward. It's what every example we have, it's what every command we have is centered around. So are you willing to rely on the Lord? Is this enough for me? Is this enough for you? Is the gospel enough? We have warnings. Hosea chapter 4 and verse 6, "My people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge, because you have rejected knowledge." They had access to it, but they had rejected it. And even Paul says in Romans chapter 10 and verse 12, or verse 2, "For I bear them witness." They have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge. A zeal for God. They love God. They have this sincere willingness to serve God, but it's not according to knowledge. Will we heed these warnings? Just a reminder, as we start to get into the meat of the lesson, this is kind of a reminder of what we talked about last night. Brad had this. Here's the organization of the church as God laid it out. You can go and you can survey, and I challenge you to do so. Did Brad miss anything? Am I missing anything when I present this? Is there some organization that's revealed in the Scriptures that's not here? I don't think you're going to find it. There's Christ the head. There's elders over the local congregation. Evangelist, no authority, but he has a role to fulfill. He's to teach and instruct. Deacons, no authority, but a role to fulfill. They're to serve. And you have the saints that are worshiping, the saints that are evangelizing, the saints that are helping the needy saints around. So I have a question. How did we get from there to what become the church, the Catholic Church? Where I have Pope, a cardinal, and under the cardinal becomes bishops, under the bishops becomes deacons, and under the deacons become the laity or the members of the saints. How did I go from this design that God had to this very hierarchical pyramid organization. Again, it grows. It didn't happen at one time. It didn't happen at one time. In nature, when you have a congregation and you have multiple leaders, there may be one who tends to be a stronger leader than the other men. And from everything that I can read through history, a lot of what started happened from just that. You had one man that had been a group that was kind of a stronger leader, kind of the one that everybody else kind of went to. Well, before long, that man started becoming the head elder, or bishop, for another name. Right? And then it was kind of nature, he's the head, and then here's your other elders, and then the flock below it. Well, you had that organization, and then you started having these bigger churches in the city, and there was these rural areas out here, and they would go and start churches. Well, who would oversee that work? This main church. And then it would be called, and then you had the city bishop was over the churches there in that city. And then from there, you started having these metropolitans, even larger circles of people, or dioceses. And then one would become the leader over all of them. And then through history, we notice that there became five of these large dioceses. Each one of their leaders started coming together, and they started coming together and making decisions called patriarchs. And then somewhere around 500 to 600 AD, you have a man that says, "Now I want to be the head of this." Any names he's a pope. At first, it doesn't go well. I have much more detail in your notes. At first, it doesn't go well. And also, for anybody that's more interested in this, there's a good overview by Aud McGee in his book, and I reference that in the notes as well. If you want to read more, I kind of got off on all kind of rabbit holes with this because I love the history. But with this, then you had this man that said, "I'm going to be the leader over all of these." At first, it was rejected. No. But in time, the second time this come up, when it happened again, finally people resigned to it. And now you have this organization, as we see here, where a man had become pope. And then you had the diocese under him, cities under him, and then churches under the city. We went from the simplistic plan that God had laid out to this. All of it because I want to be the leader of all the churches everywhere. No, that wasn't how the first man started. It just grew. It grew to the point, and then the desire for power started coming into play, and then it happened. So the first question is, how did we get from here to here? Well, era grows. Can you see this? No, this is also in your book, and you probably can't even read it in the notes of your book because the print is so small. But what I want you to show here is, how did we get from this one church that Christ established to 41,000 air quotes Christian denominations? How did we get there? How did we get from one church that the Lord had established through time to 41,000 different groups? And this statistic may be older, maybe more now. I can't even fathom 41,000 distinct Christian groups. It's hard. You know, Baptist, Southern Baptist, Primitive Baptist, Methodist, Presbyterian. I can go through and name a bunch of them, but boy, it'd take me a long time to get to 41,000, right? And I'd start pumping sand well before I got there. But that's how far we've gotten. Why is this? How did this happen? Well, as this one group started growing and power started happening, you think everybody liked the way this one man at the top was ruling and these patriarchs that was up here was ruling all these churches? No. People started seeing the error in it. And even on top of that, you had the Roman government that had been trying to defeat the church. Read the book of Revelation. They can't beat the church, so now they start trying to infiltrate the church. And somewhere in the late 500s, you have a man, the Rome actually says, "I'm going to say, you know, this emperor is the pope." So now you have the government involved in the church. People didn't like that. The Greek Orthodox quickly spun off and come to the side. And that's the two major panels you see coming through. And from there, you have different Protestant reformations and these different movements that splintered off because people were seeing that, hey, something's happened here. And each in their own way was trying to get back to what that New Testament pattern was. But what has happened is because these small errors happened, we've gotten where we are today, to 41,000. That number is huge in my book. Authorized work of the church. Just a reminder again, right? What do? We worship, we preach the gospel, and benevolence, where we help those needy saints around us. This is what we can be doing. When we deviate from that, problems happen. This is just a couple of slides of quick review of what you saw last night, what you went through with Oscar and Brad last night. One, you have, there is one church giving money to one man to go out and preach the gospel. And there are some, and this, those should be in your notes as well, and you can download the PowerPoint if you so desire. Don't have time to go to all these passages. Those are the passages to talk. You have one church giving money to one man to go out and preach the gospel. You have other examples where there's many churches. Paul said, I robbed other churches. So you have many small groups over here. If you can't see, this is small little groups over here. Small congregations over here giving money to one man to go out and preach the gospel. Paul says, I robbed other churches. Okay? So, and then in the world of benevolence, you have a church, and inside that church there's needy members. And you have examples there, all the way back to Jerusalem, where people sold their possessions, laid it at the elders' feet, and they distributed as the need existed there. You have cases where one church sent to the elders of the churches in Judea. So here I have one church sending relief, sending benevolence, sending aid to these churches that are in Judea. And then you also have many churches that are sending money back to a single church. Money is brought back, laid at the elders' feet in the church of Jerusalem for the famine that's going on there, and passages that goes on there. And that's about all I can find. Again, if I'm going to do things in the name of the Lord, I've got to find the Scripture for them. And that's about all that I can find. So with that being said, how did we get from churches helping their own members, or multiple churches helping the members at a congregation, to the more modern movement of missionary societies, orphan home, retirement home, colleges, schools, publications, TV, radio, fellowship halls, softball fields, gyms, contemporary services, and the one that just kind of took my breath away was, I was reading an article not too long ago, a bar church. I can't get people to come to me, so now we're going to take the gospel and we're going to go to the bar with them. The person even went as far as say, yes, we do go ahead and partake of the alcohol with them. But because so that we can blend in, we can be there, and we can reach them. How did we get so far? How have we gotten so far? We don't have time to hit every one of these individually. Are they legitimate work? Some of them, yes. Mission, supporting preachers. Yeah, that's one of the works of the church. TV, radio program. If it is teaching and it is the work of the church there, doing the preaching and teaching, yes, that's very much a work of the church. Widows that have needs, that's among the saints there. Widows indeed. Yes, that's a work of the church. But there's some of these that come in, like education. Nowhere in the Scriptures do I find that human education is a work of the church. But it got there. Over time. Schools, colleges, an orphan home. And we'll talk about these. But there is a very key concept. If I run out of time today, and I get nothing else across, and you need something to bounce, as you go through life and you need something to bounce things off of, please remember these next two slides. There is a key concept that I want us to notice in 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. The elders who are among you I exhort, I whom a fellow elder, a witness of the suffering of Christ, also a partaker of the glory that will be revealed, shepherd the flock which is among you, serving as overseers, not by compulsion, but willingly, not for dishonest gain, but eagerly. We could even go to the bottom and say, not for a dishonest gain. And we can see some of that power that came in that creation of the Roman Catholic Church and power structure that ended up there. But the key I want us to see here, which is among you, does the elders at Eastside have any control or any authority over what's happening at Pepper Road or Jones Road? No. Did God have any plans whatsoever for there to be a group of elders that oversaw what's going on at this congregation, that congregation, and another congregation?
enough. Try to find it. It's not there. It's not there.
If we can get this fact, I think a lot of everything else will come into play. The work that's being done by church, again, what are we doing? Worshiping, evangelizing, and benevolence. Which is among you? That's where the elders' oversight stops. Acts chapter 20, verse 28, he had called the elders together. Therefore, take heed yourself into the flock, which is among which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers to shepherd the church, which is He purchased with His own blood. All the flock among which you oversee. Where's the elders' realm? The elders' realm is within that local congregation. Okay? Most of the questions that was asked, most of the things that have happened through history has come from a deviation of trying to go outside that realm and to do works that are beyond it. The first one I want to talk about is what came to be known as missionary societies or sponsoring churches. The reason for this sounds innocent enough. Let me just give you the reason, and I want you to see if this sounds kind of innocent to you. Here's a small little church in rural Limestone County, in a small little church in rural Jackson County, Mississippi. They don't have a lot that they can do. They can't call this guy up in Guatemala and say, let me pay you to preach where you're doing this. They just don't have the funds to do so. But someone said, hey, look, if I take their funds and their funds and put all of the funds of these small rural places together, look how much good I can do. Let that sink in for a minute. On the surface, that sounds pretty good, doesn't it? My little church can't do anything of ourselves, but if I pool my money with this group and with this group and with this group, if we put our monies together, all kind of great things can be done. More than I can do by myself. But now, let me ask a question. At the point that I send my money to another congregation, and they start sending out preachers, who controls that work? Is it now the elders overseeing the work that's among them? What if that person starts preaching something wrong? Can the elders at this small little group over here decide, that's it, we're cutting their support? No. Who has to make that decision? The big one in the middle. I can't. No longer is the elder at this local work here overseeing the work that's being done. That's where it breaks down. Quite literally every time. That's how we got there. The defense, the board's just a method. These commands, visit the orphans, the fatherless, the widows, visit them in their use, in their need. These are just methods. These are how we're going about doing that work. Well, actually, it's more than just how we're going about doing that work. You have put yourself in a situation that no longer is the elders of that local congregation overseeing the work that's being done. From their monies, from their... Yes, Josh? Mm-hmm. I'm getting close enough to hear you. Okay. That was actually the concept that started this whole thing, to be honest, because I don't have the money individually, this one doesn't have the money individually. If they're collaborating and each of the three are sending separate checks to the work, you know, I'm sending a check to the work, that's this congregation's work to do. That congregation, they can send money to the work. But where we've got to make sure we don't do is, if I go back a slide here, we're not sending money to another organization or another group of elders to oversee that work. Because at that point it's no longer ours to oversee. So this is not just simply how. This is who's doing the work. Whose work does it become? And then, after that happened, this kind of opens the gates for many other things. You had institutional boards that was overseeing orphan homes in the picture here. There's other things, retirement homes, those kind of things that happen. And again, I ask, you've got these little groups out here sending money to this group here that's now providing food, supervision, shelter for the orphan. Okay? The question I have to ask, whose work is this? Is it this little church that's up here? If something's happened they don't like, can they affect any change? No. All the change, all the authority, all the work is being done by this group. They're a part of it. They're sending money to it. But it's no longer their work. It's the work of this group. And for that, we just simply have no authority. Now, we're going to use an example and come back to the orphans in just a minute. One of the things is that I hear a lot is, we've just gotten so keyed up. We're legalists. We've gotten so keyed up into this. God just, you know, almost just this laughter. We've got to get over ourselves. God just don't care that much about this stuff. I want to ask you something. If we go and we look in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verses 3 through 16, where God says, you know, here's the widows that the church can help out of its own funds. Does this look like someone who does not care how the church spends its money? That the person, before they can be helped out of the treasury, they must be left alone. They must trust in the Lord. They must continue still being in supplication and prayer, not in daily. They must be over 60. The wife of one man, well reported for good works, brought up children, lodged strangers, washed the saints' feet, relieved the afflicted, diligent to every good work. That's kind of a detailed qualification list for someone who could be helped out of the church's treasury. Does that sound like a God that doesn't care how the church has spent its money? I think that alone says that God cares. In 1 Timothy chapter, looking at verse specifically at verse 4, but if any widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to show piety at home and to repay their parents for the good that is acceptable before God. Verse 16, if any believing man or woman has a widow, let him relieve them, and do not let the church be burdened that they may relieve those who are widows indeed. The point I'm making here is, do not let the church be burdened that they can spend their money helping those that are widows indeed. Does it sound like God cares? So this concept of you're just blowing this out of proportion, you're making mountains out of molehills, God just don't care that much about this stuff. I believe He does. And I believe if He didn't care, He wouldn't give us such strict guidelines for who could be helped out of the church's treasury. So what's wrong with orphan homes? Should orphans be helped? Should it be cared for? Well, yes, definitely. If someone was to bring, and this did happen a couple of decades ago, bring small children and stand them up before the people and say, should these small children not be cared for and loved and given home and comfort? Definitely, yes. But that's not the question in my mind. The question is, who should do it? Who should do it? Is that a work that we can put this middleman organization in the middle of that they can do it? And if we look at James chapter 1, which is the text that one would go to for this conversation, I don't expect you to be able to see the screen. But what I hope you can see is the number of red marks on the screen. In James chapter 1, blessed is the man, for when he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life. Let no one, he, each one, I, his own, every man, anyone. Does this sound like the context of a congregation? This sounds like each man. Every man, each one. This is instructions that's given to you and to me. So should that orphan be cared for? Absolutely. But Tracy should do it. Wayne should do it. Steve should do it. Not the church with its funds. That the church with his funds is not what James is saying here. Here it is, individual responsibility, not man's responsibility. Context shows everything. Turn with me to Acts chapter 2. I'm actually doing a little better on time than I thought I was going to. In Acts chapter 2, let's take this. We could look at any of them, but let's take this one as an example. Social needs, it actually came out of a lot of political things some time ago that a lot of the social gospel that we have today started. God says that we should reach out and we should help all men. Benevolence, right? Yeah, we should help. But what's the extent of that help? Even our last president, George Bush, I agree with a lot of his policies, but when he was trying to replace Social Security, what was the term that he used a lot for his idea of what should be offering up that social? This is where I see his paying attention. in the news. Faith-based organizations should take this work on. This concept of social gospel, it is there, and it's been there for some time. Faith-based organizations should take on the care of the feeding and the needy and the people who have needs of the world. But again, we looked at it last night, so we don't have time to go into it again. It's of the saints that the church is to help. Now, me as an individual, yes, I'm to be good to all men. But the church is charged to take care of those that are needy there among them. Now, Acts chapter 2, verses 45, but they would say, but let those who gladly received His word and were baptized, and that day about 3,000 souls were added. And they continued steadfast in the apostles' doctrine, in fellowship, in breaking bread, and in prayers. So, here they are. They're taking, fear become on every one of them. They had all things in common. They sold their possessions, and they divvied the possessions up to each as they had need. Right? In 44 and 45. They sold their possessions. They parted them to all men as each had need. Is this all men everywhere universal? What's the context? Who is the all men? If you scroll back up, who's the all men here? Isn't it those that have, the 3,000 that we just talked about that have been saved? Those that have been added to the church? There's most times when these things happen, verses are pulled out of context. Another example of that is Galatians chapter 6 and verse 10. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially those who are a household of faith. That's right. This is all men everywhere, right? But who is the instructions to? If I was to go back and look at the verses preceding, just like in James, look at our red, each one, his, him, a man, he, his, he. Does that sound like pronouns that reflect the church? That's individual. So yes, who's to do good to all men? I'm to do good. Steve's to do good. Wayne's to do good. Greg's to do good. You're to do good to all men. But not to the church's treasury. To the church's treasury, it comes for those of the needy saints. And that's last night, so we can't go there again. Most of the things that have happened, we said that it grows. And it grows because things that were good in and of themselves turned into bigger things. The issue was not whether someone could eat or drink in the building. Right? The issue is whether the building is not whether the building was sacred. It was, is there authority for the church to build a building, a place, where social activities could happen? Well, is those social activities, is it the preaching of the gospel? Is it the worship? Is no. Those aren't the things that's going to be going on in that place. That's the question. So let's make sure when we go through time, let's ask the real question. What are the purpose of things like Cappuccino in Christ? Casual, early casual services or contemporary services, right? Plays, performance, musicals, softball teams, gyms. What are their purposes? It's to draw people in. It is to draw people in. I come from a background that I remember growing up with a softball team. And the rules within that little church that I went to, that if you wanted to play on the softball team, you had to attend so many times. And if you didn't attend that week, you couldn't play that game. Right? So if you wasn't at church that week, you couldn't play in that game on Thursday night or Saturday. It got people there for the duration of softball season. It didn't get people to Christ. It converted people to softball. It did a really good job because people wanted a place to play softball. And it did a really good job allowing them to have a place where they could have physical exercise. And we could say the same thing about a gym or anything else. But when I'm going out to people and trying to bring people to Christ, Romans chapter 1 and verse 16, what did it say? What's the power of God in salvation? I'm back to being comfortable with silence. What's the power of God in salvation? The gospel. The gospel is the power of God in salvation. And when we do things like this, we change that. And we say that God's gospel is not good enough in and of itself. We need something else to get people in the doors. We cannot do that. Do not be ashamed of that gospel. And the last thing that I had there was Message from the Mound. That's something we found just a few weeks ago. Travel ball baseball has become huge, and I'm sure it's true in softball and other sports as well. I see it more in baseball. And most of these tournaments are Friday, Saturday, Sunday tournaments. And people, you know, people want to go to church, but, you know, but it's baseball. So these local churches have started doing these things. Well, we'll do Message on the Mound early on Saturday, Sunday morning before the tournament starts. So that everybody that wants to travel out of town and go to these tournaments can come and we'll have this message from the mound. And different groups are providing different speakers for different times. Again, over and over and over again. We've got these things we're trying to draw people in, but we tend to be drawing them in to the wrong thing. I put this up here so that you can see where this context comes from. And that's in your notes as well. And I promise when I was putting this together, that was not lime green. I would not use lime green, I promise. That was not lime green. But that is the URL I got this from, and just a few notes. This is a group that's doing studies about helping people grow their congregations, right? Helping people grow their congregations. Well, the first thing was, chances are your local church is moving away from the traditional formats and attempt to fill every pew. Okay, what's that saying? The gospel is no longer good enough. Let's go to something new. And that's where all these other things come in. At South Church in Andover, Massachusetts, was debated to hold an alternate service. We're going to hold another service. When should we do this? It wasn't what they had holy. It was not what would be best. It's, let's do a survey of when are the people free? When is the most convenient time during the week for people to come together? A market survey was done. Even to the point of what I would almost call silliness. There was a gentleman in Arkansas that said, we can get people in. Let's do Who Wants to Be a Millionaire instead of services one Sunday night a month. And we'll bring random contestants up out of the crowd, we'll play the game, and the winner gets $1,000. Did you get people in the door? Yeah, I got people in the door. But was it to the gospel? No, it was to $1,000. We cannot be ashamed of the gospel. Have we forgotten? We cannot be, for I was not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. Everywhere the apostles went, they went taking the gospels. I want to leave you today, and I want to leave this as we're getting ready to go into our song. I want to leave this up before you. Carnal enticements that hope to produce spiritual desires send the simple message that Jesus is not enough. Original me, absolutely not. I put Daniel's name up because this comes straight off of Facebook, just as Steve said last night. I couldn't have said it better, so I'm not going to attempt to. Carnal enticements that hope to produce spiritual desires send the simple message that God is not enough. Shame on us when we try to lure people. Bait and switch. We're going to lure you to Christ with this, and once we get here, we're going to try to switch something else in its place. Never be guilty of that. The gospel is the power. Remember that as you go forward. Now, this whole weekend is about where do I fit in? What do we do? Why are we doing it? Where do I fit in? I hope as you listen, I hope you're making notes to yourself, this is where I can fit in. And this is where I go back to Pepper Road, I go back to Northport and Tuscaloosa, wherever I might be going back to, this is where I can go and this is where I can be a valuable asset to the church there. Thank you for your time.